Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Matt Truman, and with me today are Little Bulb, specifically Dominic Conway, Claire Beresford and Alexander Scott. This young company have established themselves as firm Edinburgh Fringe favourites after a string of shows that could only have been made by them. Among the hallmarks of their work are a hearty sense of music, have-a-go heroics of the untutored amateur, and a homespun chaos. There's also masses and masses of charm to them. They flip from genre to genre. Sporadical was an epic folk opera, Goose Party a theatrical gig, and they presented their own touring village fete of sorts in the past. For their latest show, Little Bulb have fused opera, gypsy jazz, and 1930s Parisian music hall to retell the Orpheus myth in their own inimitable style. Dominic, Claire, Alex, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Hello. Hi.
Now, I'm gonna start, for the benefit of the listener, by getting you all to just introduce yourselves very quickly so we can get attuned to your voices. So, Alex, why don't you kick us off?
I'm Alex Scott, and I directed the show, and I'm also in it.
I'm Claire Beresford. I play the double bass in the show.
I'm Dominic Conway, and I play the guitar.
Fantastic. So let's start with the present. Let's start with Orpheus. It seems to me quite an extraordinary thing for a young company to go, let's tackle a Greek myth. So why the story of Orpheus? What drew you to that?
Well, David Jubb, the artistic director of BAC, commissioned us to do a big project, and that had a lot of freedom attached to that. Like, we could have done anything. We could have come up with our own story. But we thought we'd adapt something because we'd never done it before. And we thought we'd adapt the Orpheus myth because it's so, well, it's such an interesting story with so much to say about music. And that's one of our sort of key things that we're interested in. You know, why people make music and what effect music has. So, yeah, that's why, basically.
Mm. And you've framed it in this, this rather extraordinary way of presenting the story as presented in a sort of authentic French 1930s music hall mode. Why did that come about?
We wanted to... We knew early on that we were going to pair Orpheus, the myth, with Django Reinhardt, the very real person, the legend. He's a really, like, an Orphic figure. He's very mysterious and had a fantastic, very exciting life with lots of sort of ups and downs, but, you know, and all this incredible music legacy. And the reason why we decided on that framing device was we've been doing the project for 2 years now in development. We started working on just the music, you know, getting inside the music, playing the music. And in early scratch performances, which is the BAC terminology for doing these sort of little performances to show where you're at with the work at various stages, we would have to present that material. And it just seemed right and proper to present it in a period... towards period costume, and giving the audience like a sort of sensation of maybe going back in time. And I suppose at that point we were sort of subconsciously saying we embrace that framing device, and that's what's sort of led us to you know, basically then flesh that out in sort of a big way. At that early stage we could have decided, no, we're going to present this music in a very modern way, we're going to put a very modern take on it, or, you know, whatever combination of different avenues, but that's basically why.
Now, Dominic, you play Django Reinhardt. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little about him and what the appeal was of him as this figure.
Well, I think we've all been very passionate about his music before we started the project. I myself got really into Django as a teenager, and my guitar teacher would tell me little fascinating details about his life, like that he was a gypsy growing up in Paris, and that he'd had this caravan fire where two of his fingers had become a kind of knot of scars, semi-paralyzed, so hence the legend that he only had two fingers on one of his hands. and his music I always find so imaginative and so surprising and absolutely exemplary of this idea of being in the moment. And you could just tell by the choices he makes and how he's surprising himself and you, that it's the true spirit of jazz and art, if you like. So I've always really admired his playing and loved to learn some of the songs. So this was really great opportunity to properly work at it, because it's the kind of music that, unless you're doing a couple of hours a day for an extended period of time, you're not going to cover much ground.
Yeah, I think the thing with Gypsy Jazz is, like, we've been going to this place down the road called the Cucumber, and I personally didn't, like, know that much about, we've had it on in the house for, like, years, but I didn't know much about Gypsy Jazz as a genre, and kind of the little world it has within it. This bar's amazing, and on Tuesday nights they have this, like, open playing nights. And I think the thing, especially about Gypsy Jazz guitar, is it's so fast, and it does look so... The guitarists make it look so easy, but they're doing things that you are just insanely skilled, and they just don't... I mean, it's just in a tiny bar in Latchmere that no one knows about, doing, like, just the most virtuosic thing.
Because guitar is probably, like, one of the most played instruments, you know. A lot of people can bash out a couple of songs. When you've been playing guitar in a sort of more of a sort of folk or rock tradition, and then you sort of start unpacking what the Gypsy Jazz music does with the guitar, it uses, like, the whole fretboard. You use all of your fingers. You have to do chord shapes that you just wouldn't think are possible, and that they're all so it's a really amazing subgenre. That, I mean, it's, you know, and you can see why people devote themselves to it, and they get lost in it because they love it so much. We went to Samwa's festival, which is where Django ended up at the end of his life and where he died, and they have a festival every year, and it was just amazing. We were sort of staying in the musicians' camp, and there's just all these enthusiasts. They just love it so much.
They didn't go to bed. They were just... I mean, I loved it as well, but it was like 5 in the morning, either side, someone's starting to play or someone's just finishing playing. You just, like, you get a bit, like, the song's on a loop in your head, like, yeah.
But it's very rich music. I think when you're listening to swing music, it's easy to think, oh, this is just quite simple. It's, like, it's pootling along. It doesn't seem necessarily that complicated, but when you break it down and start sort of getting into it, and especially in terms of improvisation and what you can do musically with that, I think it has been a really fun journey to go on for everyone. Like, how do we make our solos interesting? Well, Dominic's sort of been doing jazz lessons with us, and that's sort of... We've been trying to collectively get better at things like that.
You went to Holland, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell us about that. Because I was going to say, I mean, when I was reading about Django, and he's routinely held up as one of the sort of momentary revolutionaries of guitar playing. Mm. How does one go about becoming able to play this sort of stuff?
Well, it's a lot more accessible than I thought that it would be. I, quite early on, really nervous about whether I would be able to play it, decided to go for this 4-day course in Holland with this wonderful guitarist called Lolo Mier, and he is a gypsy, and he lives in a caravan community, and you can go and stay with him in a spare caravan that he has, and he just would teach me 4 hours a day or a bit more, just no exact structure. It would just happen sometime in the morning, take a break, and then sometime in the afternoon. And he's a really authentic player of the early Django Reinhardt style. There's loads of chord shapes. A lot of these chord shapes are based around the disability that Django had, and so he had to find slightly different approaches that are still mimicked by players of the genre.
Because it's his left hand, isn't it, on the,
yeah,
the fretboard?
Yeah, it's the fretboard hand, so the chord shapes have to change a bit, and actually makes for some really rich, imaginative approaches to harmony, because he couldn't play some of the more conventional shapes. Mm. So he had to go for the less conventional ones, which is perfect for jazz.
Mm.
And also, yes, yeah, some really clever ideas about a kind of sleight of hand. If you can't play one chord, but there's maybe another chord that will imply that chord. And lots of things to do with, yeah, there's so many songs to learn, so many details about the technique, how you hold the guitar, how you attack it. It's a very full-on approach, but the great thing about gypsy jazz is it does have a few elements that once learned, you can apply them to any song and start playing jazz quite quickly. And I think the big difference is that with gypsy jazz, you've still got the four rhythm of like chuck, 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 chuck. But with a lot of other types of jazz, it seems like much more mysterious. The drummer will be going and the bass player will be going, and any guitarists or pianists are just kind of like jutting out like interesting chords at in very improvised rhythms. But I always found that a bit hard to judge. But there's something about the gypsy jazz which is, it's kind of instant. You know what you're going to be doing,
and it's incredibly jolly.
Yeah,
like it's great party music, and it's great. We were sort of in the park the other day, sort of practicing, and it was just so nice. The rhythm's just constantly going, and then you get these like lovely melodies.
So I'm just wondering, why pair Django Reinhardt with Orpheus? What about him? Yeah, I mean, you use the term Orphic figure. What specifically makes him the perfect person to play Orpheus?
Well, I think he's just so enigmatic, mysterious. And when we started researching his life in more detail, all of these wonderful stories emerged. I think a lot of people know him for the sort of pre-war swing music that he was doing. But he had all these sort of other ambitions sort of going on. Like he wanted to write an organ mass for the sort of gypsy people. He wanted to do a sort of a piece for massed voices that Jean Cocteau was going to write the libretto for. These things were written, but then there was like a combination of, they just got sort of got lost, or Django wouldn't sort the rehearsals out, so the productions wouldn't come off. And we just thought there was something really interesting about Django the character, Django and his music, and the idea of this sort of performance, like a conceptual performance, tying together a lot of sort of 1930s musical styles, fusing classical imagery with like a modern day to the 30s imagery, and sort of a concept piece where Django was cast, which I think really sort of appropriate for all the sort of mad things that were going on in the 30s artistically. So yeah, and he is just a fascinating, fascinating character. And it just sort of, there was one phrase that kept on coming up in the research, that like he was said to play the guitar with a human voice. And he was also saying, you know, he was actually quite a shy person. Amongst gypsies, perhaps less so. But he very much let his guitar do the talking. And Orpheus is like that as well. His lyre or his poetry or in whatever version does the talking and has these incredible effects. And even now, that idea of the ability to charm people... with the music, and Django was sort of always getting out of scrapes by, you know, charming the police or playing for them, or he had to, you know, to play music during the war to stay alive. It was the fact that he was such a good musician that kept him in work, and, you know, it could have gone very badly for him if he didn't have that ability. So there's loads of sort of things to pick up on that idea.
Also, you can read about them both, but and there's like masses and masses and masses of Django recordings, but you want to like hear him speak or see him on the in a film, but like there's like one tiny. So he is kind of like mythic in a way. Like you can only hear him through a guitar.
Yeah, like that's true for, because there's film footage of a lot of other people, and for some reason there's just not a lot, and that does make him more mysterious.
He's just like, wow, you can't get a handle on this guy.
The other thing that struck me was, I mean, when you're playing him, Dom, when you're sitting front curtain, the gaze that you put on individual audience members, it's almost struck me as having this sort of cobra-like hypnotistic quality, and I was wondering whether that might have ties with Orpheus. Obviously he's undone by his look back, whether there was something in that.
Oh, I think I just like looking at the audience members for the fact. I just like looking at the ladies. I hadn't made that connection in my mind. I think in general we don't know a whole lot about how Django held himself when he was playing the music. We have read pretty much all there is written about him, but then when we came to make the performance, we took a lot of artistic license. So it's mainly coming from a place of what we think is going to be successful theatre, with like a heavy nod towards what we know about Django.
And also the looking at the audience, I think, is rooted in our sort of attempt to communicate the music to the audience. I think what we're trying to do with a lot of our shows is to not just have something a bit impassive on stage that might be technically right, and we always sort of make the trade-off for less good technically and more communicative, and then we try and upgrade the technique when we can.
In the spare time, in the park.
So what Dom's doing there is it's quite complicated what you're doing, really, isn't it? So you're playing something quite difficult, but you're connecting. Instead of being introspective, like to the guitar, it's like connecting those, and I think it helps the music land. Like you land the looks on the chords that are suggestive, and that's why it feels charming, I think.
And I mean, why use music so prominently in all your work? What is it in a theatre context what does that do to a piece of theatre?
I think music cuts through very immediately to add sort of an emotional sort of inner space that we aspire to do that with everything. Like, I think text can do that as well, and imagery, of course. But music is fascinating because it's a technical exercise in one sense. It's something that can be learned and improved. Like in some of the technical stuff in the show, hopefully if people resonate with the time it would have taken to do that, it's not sort of throwaway. So I think you can connect with the audience through a sort of sense that's been rehearsed for them and it's been given back to them. And then I think purely emotionally, music is understandable in some sort of very abstract way by everyone. And, you know, when the organ's going and you sort of the room sort of vibrating, it's can be a physical thing as well. You know, it cuts through.
Yeah, sometimes it just expresses things that you cannot express, that just feelings you have. And, like, I think with other things, whereas, like, literature or, like you say, imagery or things can be really moving and do the same thing. You have to actively, like, engage with a piece of art or read a book, whereas music could be on, like, background music in a cafe and affect you subconsciously because, I mean, isn't it, like, scientifically proven that it does have an emotional effect on us, on everybody? And I just think, I don't know, something about whether you go to, like, watch a big piece of theatre, depending on, like, the context, but if you go to a massive concert, like, there's just more, there's kind of this unity that you can't, like, buy, or, like, if you're all into the same person, you're standing next to someone in the field, and you just kind of, I don't know, it's just, I think it is magical, in a way.
I think the other really important thing is that, to contrast with Django's expressing himself through the guitar, that our Yvette Pepin compere character, who's modelled on Edith Piaf, speaks with you know, her own voice, and we, you know, sings a number of songs, and I think there's something really interesting about the human voice and how that cuts, that sort of almost trumps everything. It's like the trump card, just people responding to a voice sort of crying out or singing out, and all the emotion that sort of, like, when you listen to Edith Piaf, it's just like, it's like this force of nature, and that was sort of another very fun element, and it's like a contrasting element as well.
And for someone who has their, like, passion and emotion, like, wears their heart so much in the sleeve, where it's almost, like, so vulnerable, you're like, they're any second they're going to fall apart, but they're just hanging on, they're just, you know, some of her ending notes are just, like, so crazy, but she, it's just amazing that she's just putting herself out there and sort of speaking for everyone that's whatever else other people maybe wouldn't be able to share it with everybody, but she's just going... And it's very moving.
I was thinking on the train on the way here, actually, about the theatrical naïfs that run through your work. I mean, even going back to Cryptosmia, your very first show, you had the Battenberg cake puppet theatre, Sporadical, a family putting on this show for the rest of their family gathering, and we as the audience were playing the part of the rest of the family. And then even in Operation Greenfield, these teenagers putting a band together for this Battle of Bands competition. And again, in Orpheus, what is it about that that quality, that sort of mode, the untutored amateur, the plucky have-a-go hero that works so much for you?
Well, I think we like having a go. And we often, like, I was thinking about this, you know, we're all sort of picked up new instruments along the way. We sort of just sort of do it and see what happens. And, you know, it can be a bit nerve-wracking, but it sort of, I think it's really fun to have a go. And I guess that sort of trope just probably allows us to express that, you know, quite confidently. And I think the other thing about it is that it gives the audience an identity as well, and it encourages them to be the part of the fiction, or to sort of invest heavily in the fiction, or to have a relationship with us that, you know, already sets them up for perhaps a sort of warmer experience than they might have otherwise. But yeah, I think that's sort of at the heart of it.
And I wouldn't say, like, all the parts within those shows are, like, for instance, John, you couldn't perform Django with a sort of, try my best. You know, I think you have to actually be skilled and charming, whereas maybe, like, I know me personally, like, and it's probably a bad thing, like, but when, like, I'm on the bass, it's sort of, even though I think the energy, like, as kind of Tripus is putting out there, is mainly just geared towards you. we're also, like, you know, trying to charm the audience and get rid of potential agents, and we're playing that kind of thing. But I suppose maybe our personalities creep through, and I definitely know my personality is like, you know, God, please, thank God I get this note. And, like, and maybe that just reads more than I
think it does, but you know, I don't want my characters to be like, God, I'm terrible and I've got to pull that off. But it's but
more than any show that we've done, I think this show has been about exuding confidence,
yes,
and
yes,
assurance,
yeah.
You know, which might pick up on, you know, why it was sort of different when you saw it, or you sort of had a sort of different reaction to it. But yeah, we've worked very hard to sort of get that idea of, yes, like Django is very good. He just knows that what he plays would be perfect. Like, Yvette knows that she can't sing a wrong note. Like, they're very, like, forceful figures. The band is, like, everything we do for them. We're like soldiers, and, like, they're the generals. In our other shows, what we've done is actually got things to a very technical place, but just communicated, we'll have a go here.
Right, yeah.
I think what you're picking up on is the acting rather than the music. I think what we do is we just spend hours and hours nailing it technically, and then work about, well, what energy do we want to give that? You know, whereas the energy is different. It is a bit more sort of brash and big, but I think that really suits the era, and it suits the characters, suits the egos involved.
I think that's a really interesting point to make. The actual naives are very much the characters, but what they're actually doing, the quality with which they're doing it in all of your work is very, very refined. And I mean, I think that clearly shows in this, the games that you're playing as Django, the performance register, the games that that Eugenie is playing as Yvette, they're very, very precise along the way. On the note of Have a Go Heroes, we should look ahead to the summer, because you're putting on your dancing shoes for your first ever dance show. Tell me about that as a decision that you guys made.
Well, Alex here is we haven't made too much of it yet, so like to say much about it would probably be guess the best. But yeah, it's our first foray in sort of dance theatre, and as you may know, none of us are professionally trained in dance, so it'll be really. I mean, I'm really excited about it, because there's something in the same way that music can be played if you want to have a go by anyone. I mean, with all whatever body you have, you can move it to express something, and I suppose, you know, there's no harm in having a go, and I'm really excited to be putting the focus on that rather than our musical ability for a change. Not that there's no music in it, but I think the focus will be more on our physicality and what that will express. And I don't know, it depends what you make of it. If people doing things that they're not trained in, but I think that's why, if you love it or you hate it, that's why it would be interesting.
Because we want, I think with a lot of these things, like, we like watching musical performance and we like watching physical performance as well, so it's about that, having a go at sort of celebrating and exploring something that we're interested in anyway. Like, we're interested in seeing bodies do interesting things, so. But we don't have the technical language to go, well, that's a sort of pirouette there, and that's a, you know, they're doing arabesque there or whatever. So it's been fun to do it from, like, no experience, like, just going, oh, yeah, what's that movement's interesting? Why? You know, why is it interesting? Or, you know, that's incredibly dull. We wouldn't want too much of that.
Right, yeah.
Like, why is it dull? I think that's the same in music, actually. It's really similar. Like, when we were looking at the improvisation, you know, why is something, you know, sometimes it's the simpler things can be more interesting. At other times, that you need the technique to sort of create the sense of movement. It's very, very mysterious.
And also, I think it's really fascinating when people do things from a place of no knowledge. And that's not to say that, like, obviously, if you study dance your whole life and have all the vocabulary that you wouldn't be phenomenal or deserve to be phenomenal, but at the same time, to make discoveries out of without the vocabulary, I think is a very exciting way to come at it, because like you say, you'll sort of make your own rules as you go, and it'll be interesting to see like what from the sort of renowned dance vocabulary is sort of feeds in and what doesn't, and what dancers who are trained make of it, as well as people who don't dance at all. Or yeah, I think it'd be really fascinating. It must be like if you're a kid sort of goes into doing art and they just, you know, why is that colour interesting? Why is that shape interesting? And they haven't, you know, studied art history or whatever. They just, that's what they want to see because it's exciting for them.
That must be quite an important quality then, the love, the passion that goes into these performance registers.
Yeah, I think we just, as people, maybe like things to be exciting or like, I think it's engaging.
And we like a challenge.
Yeah,
we do. You know, and we've done a lot with music. I think like Orpheus is like the biggest scale that we've done, and we're really looking forward to exploring physicality because we feel it's been a really important part of our work, but we've never gone, oh, but that, you know, this will be a dance show, or you know, so it feels like a dangerous place to go to in a way, but that feels good as well, you know.
Fantastic. Alex, Claire, Dominic, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Orpheus is on at the Battersea Arts Centre until the 11th of May, and you can catch Squally Showers up at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival this summer.